third chapter of Joshua. We're going to look at an extremely important moment in the history of Israel tonight, and it will go on into the fourth chapter with some added details, which we'll look at next time. But one of the things that I want you to see is that one of the key moments in Israel's history is about to happen. We began this series, Out of Egypt, Studies in the Providence of God, with a study in Genesis 15 where God had promised the land that was in the land of Canaan to Abraham, or rather to Abram at the time. And now that promise is about to definitely receive a great advancement as Israel actually enters the land which will be theirs. But to do that, they have to cross the Jordan River. Now, this is going to be not only a challenge for this great multitude, but it is also going to be a great step of faith and a great sign from God to a whole generation, because you remember that the men of Israel, that whole wicked generation of unbelievers, died out. And so their widows and their young children and their babies were left. And so the large majority of the people in our story tonight had not seen the crossing of the Red Sea. They had heard about it, but they were not actually there when it happened, except, as I say, for some of the widows, some of the men who might have remembered it as teenagers or as younger. And there were two very, very old men in Israel who remembered it. They were about 80 years old. Who were they? Joshua and Caleb. They remembered the crossing of the Red Sea. Come on in. There's room up at the front here. An usher will show you to some of our choicest seats up here. That's perfectly all right. We don't mind being the second half of a double feature. You know, it's just when we have to be the first half that the problems arise. Good to see y'all. Anyway, I'm expounding before we get to verse 1, so you haven't missed anything. Joshua chapter 3, verse 1, then Joshua rose early in the morning, and they set out from Shittim, and they came to the Jordan, he and all the people of Israel, and lodged there before they passed over. So the two old men, Joshua and Caleb, remembered the Red Sea, but hardly anybody else there did. And if they did, it was a very distant memory because it had been 40 years ago. Now, this is going to be a crucial moment. It says at the end of 3 days, verse 2, the officers went through the camp and commanded the people, as soon as you see the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God being carried by the Levitical priests, then you shall set out from your place and follow it. So what they're going to do is do like they always did. You remember that there was an order of march, there was an order of the tribes, and the Ark went before them. Then along came this tribe and that tribe and so on. As a matter of fact, that whole order of march is set out in Numbers chapter 10, and In the middle of all of that were the Levitical priests bearing the materials for the tabernacle so that the tabernacle could be pitched again, you remember. And they would set out behind the Ark of the Covenant. And so this is what they're going to do again. Now, why is that important? Why is it that they must follow the Ark? What did the Ark symbolize? What did the Ark symbolize? Yeah, the presence of God. This is what's so important about the Ark. This is why generations later at the time of Samuel, they failed in a battle where they took the Ark out as kind of a talisman, thinking that its very presence, the presence of this piece of furniture, would be enough. But the Ark was considered to be the portable throne of God. It was considered to be the place of His dwelling. You remember how it was constructed? The extensive instructions were given back in Exodus. It was 3 feet by 9 inches long, and then the width and the height were the same measurement, 2 feet 3 inches. And you remember what it had on top? Cherubim. And these weren't things that looked like rosy-rumped little porcelain angels. These were angels that you knew could kill you. They were the cherubim, and they overshadowed the ark. These were angels that you would like to have on your side. Angels that would protect God's people, but angels that also represented the presence of God in heaven. So here they were, and their wings nearly touched each other on top of the ark, and dwelling between them, dwelling among the cherubim, was understood to be the invisible God. So it was a representation of God's power and authority in heaven. And then that meant that when the ark was carried, that symbolized God going before the Israelites. So if you look back at Numbers chapter 10 for just a moment, as I told you, the order of march is there. But look at the last two verses. Numbers chapter 10, verses 35 and 36. And whenever the ark set out, Moses said, "Arise, O Lord, and let your enemies be scattered, and let those who hate you flee before you." And when it rested, he said, "Return, O Lord, to the 10,000 thousands of Israel." So in other words, Moses prayed to God. He said, "Arise, go before us, let your enemies be scattered, and we understand your presence to symbolically be represented by this ark." And then when they rested, Moses prayed, "Return, O Lord, to the 10,000 thousands of Israel." So this is what's going to happen on the bank of the Jordan.
Yes, bro. Symbolism from the actual presence of God, because, you know, the ark is a bit more than just a symbol.
Sure.
Help.
It's like communion. Next question. No, we understand when we take communion that here is an act that we do that the Holy Spirit blesses, and He comes and communes with us. But He's not in the bread, and He's not in the juice. And yet the bread and the juice are not mere memorials. It is that he uses them and the act of taking them to actually commune with us spiritually.
Yeah.
Okay. So here is something similar.
Well, it's very dissimilar also, because, you know, I understand if the bread and the cup taken unworthily, it will kill you. I understand that.
Right.
But I never have witnessed it. But I guarantee you, if somebody were to walk in that holy of holies where the ark is, he would die on the spot.
That's true. That's true. But the point is that that the ark cannot be used apart from God's will for it. So it's used on the Day of Atonement for the priest to come and sprinkle it with the blood. It is used to lead the people of Israel. But if it's ever used wrongfully, then God will punish that misuse. So, anybody want to add to that? Yes, Dave?
This kind of glory also was there at the mercy seat. Remember Ezekiel when the
right.
glory left the temple?
Yeah.
And there is where the mercy was, where the blood was atoned for, where the presence of God was. In the picture of the veil is that you can't approach God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's a little bit, you know, but that's
well, that's not reality. That's not simple. That's reality.
And well,
real thing.
The reality of this kind of glory above the mercy seat, but it was typifying, pointing to Jesus Christ, where the blood would be spilled.
And when the glory departed, then God's presence was gone from that mercy seat. Yeah. So,
Jesus came in the temple. There's one reference where he walks in the temple, looks around, leaves.
Yeah.
And I say his glory returned, and they still didn't notice.
Yeah. So this is the idea is that the Israelites found that you couldn't trifle with God because the ark was a holy object. And so we expect, for example, the Lord's Supper to be a holy sacrament, holy religious act of worship, and in that action, if it's taken unworthily, then as Paul warned, you could suffer the consequences. Some have died. So with the ark, the idea was that you followed God's instructions and you assumed that he would be blessing the ark by symbolically giving you a picture of his going before you, like the pillar of fire and like the pillar of cloud. In any event, let's build on what both Ben and Dave have said, because the Ark of the Covenant was inside the most holy place, and it was there that the blood was sprinkled. The lid of the Ark was overlaid in pure gold. And what made the symbol of the whole Day of Atonement so powerful was what was understood to be on top of the Ark, God, and what was in the ark? What was in the ark? The law. And the law had been broken. So the idea here is that blood was brought on the Day of Atonement to atone for Israel's breaking that law. That law was the Ten Commandments, which was the preamble to the whole Mosaic Law. It symbolized the entire Mosaic Law. So there's God, there's his broken law, and the message year after year is that there's no forgiveness of sins without the shedding of blood. There's got to be a substitute, and the blood must be sprinkled on that mercy seat between God and that broken law. Then it says in verse 4, "Yet there shall be a distance between you and it, about 2,000 cubits in length. Do not come near it, in order that you may know the way you shall go, for you have not passed this way before." Now, this is kind of interesting, because you can certainly understand that they, as a people, were to consider the ark so holy that they should not get near it. But this verse may well mean something else than that, because it's talking about keeping yourself about half mile distant from the ark. And it gives you the reason. "Do not come near it in order that you may know the way you shall go, for you have not passed this way before." What's the idea? You've got to be able to see it. You've got to be able to see it. It cannot be obscured. And therefore, they are to follow God into this new territory that they have not passed this way before. That's interesting about not having passed this way before. What was life like for them in the wilderness? Passing familiar places that they had passed before. This was going to be something entirely new. They were going to follow the ark to the Jordan River itself. Now, Joshua says, in verse 5, said to the people, "Consecrate yourselves, for tomorrow the Lord will do wonders among you." You remember before the Lord came down on Mount Sinai, He gave them the same commandment, consecrate yourselves. Usually it means wash yourselves, wash your garments. There's going to be something special, something set apart, something different, something holy. And so He says, consecrate yourselves, for tomorrow the Lord will do wonders among you. Verse 6, he commands the priests to take up the ark. Joshua said to the priests, "Take up the ark of the covenant and pass on before the people." So they took up the ark of the covenant and went before the people. And of course, they had to carry it in the rings that were mounted to the side of it. They had special poles that slipped through the rings, and they carried it that way without actually touching it. In verse 7 and 8, the Lord makes a very important point to Joshua, and it's something that we will see at the end of the story does in fact take place. "The Lord said to Joshua, 'Today I will begin to exalt you in the sight of all Israel, that they may know that as I was with Moses, so I will be with you.'" So He's going to validate Joshua's ministry. And one of the things that is important about this is that the idea is for God to demonstrate to all Israel that He's the same God who was with Moses, and He is going to be with Moses with Joshua as He was with Moses. Why is that an important point? Have any idea? Yes, brother.
Joshua was appointed to take Moses' place in that way the people would see that God indeed was using him as their leader.
Yes, that's right. And you remember, in spite of Moses being called, Moses giving the law, Moses being a great leader and lawgiver, that people still grumbled against him. And therefore, one of the many things that's going on here is that God is validating the ministry of Joshua, his leadership, from the very beginning, so that as the people learned over the years that God was going to be with Moses, then they've learned that Joshua is in fact his divinely chosen successor. That says that, as for you, so God is still speaking in verse 8, and as for you, command the priests who bear the Ark of the Covenant, when you come to the brink of the waters of the Jordan, you shall stand still in the Jordan. So the whole idea is that they come to the bank of the river, and then they go just into the water, and they stop. That's the instruction. Verse 9, and Joshua said to the people of Israel, come here and listen to the words of the Lord your God. And Joshua said, here is how you shall know that the living God is among you, and he will without fail drive out from before you the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Hivites, the Perizzites, the Girgashites, the Amazites, and the Jebusites. Behold, the ark of the covenant of the Lord of all the earth is passing over before you into the Jordan. Now, therefore, take 12 men from the tribes of Israel, from each tribe a man. We won't find out tonight what those 12 men are supposed to do, but Joshua says, pick them. And we'll find out in chapter 4. But in verse 13, he says, and when the soles of the feet of the priests bearing the ark of the Lord of all the earth, shall rest in the waters of the Jordan, the waters of the Jordan shall be cut off from flowing, and the waters coming down from above shall stand in one heap. Okay, let's go through what he's saying there. Several things he says about God. What does he say about God? They're very familiar things to us, but the Israelites need to be reminded of them. First of all, verse 9, come here and listen to the words of Yahweh, your God. So, this is the God who spoke to Moses in the burning bush. He gave him his name. That's what the four capital letters of Lord mean, Yahweh. Then in verse 10 it says, here is how you shall know that the living God is among you and that he will, without fail, drive out from before you the Canaanites, etc., etc., to the Jebusites. What is this saying? He is a living God. He is, again, not some sort of abstract deity that you can just build an idol to, like the Canaanites have done. He is the living God, and this miracle that he is about to perform in the Jordan is guaranteeing something. It's guaranteeing that he will without fail drive out these Canaanites. So what's going to happen is you're going to know that God is with you because this is inexplicable apart from him. And you're going to know that this is a guarantee that he will, without fail, drive out from before you the Canaanites, the Hittites, and the Hivites. And God still sends his guarantees to us. How do we know, for example, according to the Apostle Paul, that he will freely give us all the things that we need? We can go to him in prayer. We can ask for things. It's very true that he will not always grant every request, but he will give us what we need. And Paul says in the 8th chapter of Romans that he's done something that guarantees that. What was it? He did not spare his own son. He who did not spare his own son, but delivered him up for us all, how will he not with him freely give us all things? And Paul's argument is, if he gave us the greatest thing he could possibly give, his gift of his son, to actually shed that blood that could satisfy God's wrath, just like the blood on the mercy seat of the ark, only more powerfully so, then how is God not going to give you everything that you need? The death of Jesus for sinners guarantees the future blessings of God. It's in just the same way when we've been studying 1 Thessalonians. What's the guarantee that you will be raised from the dead? That the cemetery plot they put you in is going to be emptied of you one day. You're going to be regurgitated out. What's the guarantee of that? Jesus' resurrection. Yeah, he's the first fruits. He's the first fruits, and the first fruits guaranteed there would be a barley harvest 50 days later. And so, Jesus is the first fruits. His death and resurrection guarantee that you're going to be resurrected. So, in just the same way, there's a guarantee here. The living God is among you. You're going to know that just shortly. And this is a guarantee that he's going to drive out the Canaanites, the Hittites, and so on. Third thing it says about God that's amazing, and it's normal to us, but it's very important for the Israelites to grasp this. Verse 11, behold, the ark of the covenant of the Lord of all the earth is passing over before you into the Jordan. So, it isn't just that he gives law, and it isn't just that he can make spectacular smoke, fire, and thunder. And it isn't just that he has given you manna and kept the soles of your shoes from wearing out for these 40 years. He's more than the covenant God of Israel. He is the Lord of all the earth. He is the Lord of all the earth. And you'll see that in a moment because he's going to do something to the waters of the earth. And so he is your creator, he is your maintainer, he is your provider. But it is because there is no other God besides him. He is the Lord of all the earth. So you take these things that we're reminding ourselves about God tonight, that he was the God who spoke concerning the Exodus in the burning bush. He is the living God who will guarantee by this great sign that he's about to do. And he is the Lord of all the earth, and all of these things should bolster their faith as they step out into the Jordan. So in verse 14, they commence in faith. So when the people set out from their tents to pass over the Jordan with the priests bearing the Ark of the Covenant before the people. By the way, there is a very important fact that the writer of Joshua has not told us yet, and it's about to drive me nuts because I like to do things chronologically and I'm not that crazy about flashbacks, especially flashbacks that I think come at very strange times. But this writer is not me, and I am not this writer, and he has deliberately withheld an extremely important piece of information that I would have put in the first three verses. So you will kind of know that this is a divine book, not a human book only. So when the people set out from their tents to pass over the Jordan with the priests bearing the Ark of the Covenant before the people, and as soon as those bearing the ark had come as far as the Jordan, and the feet of the priests bearing the ark were dipped in the brink of the water. Hallelujah! Our author finally tells us what I've been wanting to tell you. It's in parentheses. Now, the Jordan overflows all its banks throughout the time of harvest. I would have told you that it was flooded 10 verses ago. But it was flooded. That's the idea here. That's what makes this even more incredible. And even the fact that they're proceeding in faith even more incredible. It's a spring flood of the Jordan. The water's up higher than it is supposed to be. And they're supposed to go down in it? Yes, they are. And it says that as soon as those bearing the ark had come as far as the Jordan, and splash, they dipped their feet in the brink of the water, and then our writer says, and it was a lot of water. Then in verse 16 it says, the waters coming down from above stood and rose up in a heap very far away at Adam, the city that is beside Zarethan, and those flowing down toward the Sea of the Arabah, the Salt Sea, or that we know as the Dead Sea, were completely cut off. In other words, the waters to their right stood up in a heap. The waters to their left flowed on down to the Salt Sea. And there was a path, just like the Red Sea. So they, Adam, this town, is about 18 miles away. And so this is saying that the waters rose up in a heap very far away, and the Hebrew can be translated one of two different ways. Rose up in a heap very far away from Adam, or at Adam. Now, if it is at Adam, there is one kind of miracle. If it is from Adam, then there is another kind of miracle. You see, if it's at Adam, it's saying that the waters rose up in a heap up there, 18 miles away, at Adam. And there is some historical precedent for that. Here's a little note from a Bible atlas. It was spring, a time when surging waters of the river in flood can undermine the steep Marl cliffs at Adam, 18 miles to the north. Twice within the 20th century, the collapse of these cliffs has blocked the river there, once for more than 21 hours, and the riverbed farther south has dried up. I think in Stephanie's ESV Study Bible, it actually tells you a year that this happened. I think it says something like 1920 or 1927 or something. And so this had happened. So there were basically mudslides at this area called Adam. And when the mudslides blocked the Jordan, then the Jordan quit flowing, or just kind of seeped and oozed for the next 18 miles down to this point. Now, here is the writer of the Reader's Digest Atlas of the Bible. Here is his take on it. When Joshua launched his invasion, such a providential stoppage of waters at Adam allowed the Hebrews to cross the Jordan on dry ground. So you see what the situation would have been there. If the waters went up in a heap at Adam, 18 miles away, then what happened was a providential ordering of the timing. So that when the priests stepped into the water, It was just at that moment, unbeknownst to the Israelites, unbeknownst to anybody, that the waters dissipated in their flow from up at Adam. And the waters that were left flowed on down. So it was a providential miracle of timing. At just the precise moment that those waters quit flowing at that particular spot, God sent the Israelites across. That's pretty impressive, but I don't think that's what happened. Because look at verse 6. And Joshua said to the priests, take up the Ark of the Covenant and pass on before the people. So they took up the Ark of the Covenant. And then here's what he says will happen in verse 13. And when the soles of the feet of the priests bearing the Ark of the Lord of all the earth, shall rest in the waters of the Jordan, the waters of the Jordan shall be cut off from flowing, and the waters coming down from above shall stand in one heap. If the Reader's Digest version of the miracle had happened, they could have gotten across and they could have said, Daddy, we never saw the waters stand up. See? The waters were supposed to stand up in a heap. But if they did it at Adam, they only did it at Adam, and no Israelites could see it. The miracle was not described. Some waters are going to stand up in a heap up the river a ways. And you're not going to see them, but trust me, the Lord's putting you in at just the right moment. That's not the way that the great sign and wonder was described. As a matter of fact, it is described in terms that the Bible uses to describe the parting of the blank, blank, Red Sea. Yes, that's right. Turn back with me to Exodus chapter 15, verse 8. By the way, in case you've been watching Fox News, there's another new theory about the parting of the Red Sea that they're talking about on Fox News with a completely naturalistic explanation. That's fine. Naturalistic things happen and God is in providential control over them. But one of the whole goals of those who follow this kind of stuff is never to prove the Bible, but to disprove it. So look at Exodus 15:8. Here's what Miriam sang with her tambourine. At the blast of your nostrils, the waters piled up. The floods stood up in a heap. The deeps congealed in the heart of the sea. This was a song that Israel knew. Sing to the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously. The horse and his rider he's thrown into the sea. Joshua's telling them he's going to do it again. He's going to do it again in your generation. He's going to do it again under the leadership of Joshua, just like he did with Moses. I don't know if you've ever had an experience of the Lord doing something for you that you had heard that he had done for others, but you didn't think he could do it for you. All of you have had at least one of those experiences, if you're saved. If you're converted, you have heard that he has done it for others, and he has done it for you. But I never will forget the time when Barbara and I were pretty broke, and we heard a knock at the door, and went to the door, saw a car speeding away, and we looked in the mailbox, and there was an envelope with some money. Now, we had heard about things like that on the 700 Club. But we never had experienced anything like that. There was a friend I prayed for one time who had severe back trouble, and suddenly he was healed, and he had heard about things like that, but he didn't really believe that they could happen to himself on that scale. So, brothers and sisters, what Joshua is saying here is, What you heard your parents and grandparents talk about, you are about to see demonstrated. The waters coming down from above shall stand up in one heap. And so, the point of the passage is that the water was blocked all the way up to Adam. And the water down toward the sea of the Arabah, the Salt Sea, was completely cut off, and the people passed over opposite Jericho. So it says in verse 17, "Now the priests bearing the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord stood firmly on dry ground in the midst of the Jordan, and all Israel was passing over on dry ground until all the nation finished passing over the Jordan." And that's when their faith was bolstered that they could defeat the Canaanites. They could defeat the Hittites. They could defeat the Hivites. It was designed to show them that the Lord would not fail them. Any other comments tonight about the passage? Anything? Yes, Johnny?
Well, back on there, the Lord said to Joshua to stay on and get exalted in the sight of Israel.
Yes.
Israel, one thing may not be as significant, but at that point, the oldest man in Israel was 60 years old.
Uh-huh.
He was over that age.
Yeah.
Except these two old geezers, Joshua and Caleb.
Right. Yeah.
Means
something.
Now they heard how God was killing all of their fathers on the wilderness.
Yeah.
And we got these two old guys are still here.
Yeah.
So it must be true. Now he's going to show them about parting the Jordan River like this.
That's right.
And I think that would be pretty impressive. And it does seem to be in Joshua when you get a few less occasions where they grumble to him about things.
Yeah.
There were a few, but not near as many.
That's right. Well, let's turn finally tonight to Psalm 114. The 114th Psalm is probably one that you have read and enjoyed as you've gone through your Bibles. It kind of ends, though, on a very somber note, which is how the Israelites were supposed to think about their God at this parting of the Jordan. 114, "When Israel went out from Egypt, the house of Jacob from a people of strange language, Judah became his sanctuary, Israel his dominion. The sea looked and fled, Jordan turned back." That's what we've just read about. "The mountains skipped like rams, the hills like lambs." And this is the part that always fascinated me. "What ails you, O sea, that you flee? O Jordan, that you turn back? O mountains, that you skip like rams? O hills, like lambs?" And then here is the giant killer of the answer, a very somber closing to that question. "Tremble, O earth, at the presence of the Lord, at the presence of the God of Jacob, who turns the rock into a pool of water, the flint into a spring of water." The Israelites were to learn, and the psalmist was to write, that there is nothing too hard for God. For with God, all things are possible. Amen. Yes, brother.
One point about the water stuff.
Yes.
And I think we always overlook it. Is that cross going to dry?
Yes.
So if the cliffs had fallen in and dammed up that water,
yeah,
they would still have muddy shoes.
That's right. Absolutely right. Dry is a very important word here. It is telling you that this is indeed a miracle. Yes. Yeah. That's right. That's absolutely right. Well, the argument of the scientists is that the water was standing up at Adam, where they couldn't see it. It would be, might as well stand up at Georgetown. I mean, yeah. Yeah.